In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny.
This week, Rosanna Amaka on her debut novel, The Book of Echoes.
Rosanna Amaka was born to African and Caribbean parents. She began writing her debut novel, The Book of Echoes, 20 years ago to give voice to the Brixton community in which she grew up. Her community was fast disappearing as a result of gentrification, emigration back to the Caribbean and Africa, or simply with the passing away of the older generation. Its depiction of the unimaginable pain, redeemed by love and hope, was also inspired by a wish to understand the impact of history on present-day lives. Rosanna, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you for having me.
So, how would you describe The Book of Echoes, first of all?
My child.
it's not a child now, it's an adult.
It still feels like my baby, to be honest with you. It feels like I'm letting it go on its first day at school, really, although it's been at school maybe for 2 weeks now.
So the book has an omniscient narrator, but an unusual one. Tell us about the narrator of this story.
It's narrated by an enslaved African woman that died over 200 years ago in the West Indies docks. When she was alive in Nigeria, before she was captured, she had a child on her back. And just before she was going to be captured, she threw her child into a shrine in order to save the child from the same fate as hers. So then it comes forward to she lands in the West Indies docks and she has a second child. And that second child is taken away from her and she dies. And she basically roams the earth trying to find her lost children.
The story is then split into to begin with, two strands. One set, both set in the early 1980s, one in Brixton and the other in Nigeria.
Yeah.
Michael, the character that is growing up in Brixton, tell us who he is, first of all.
Michael is a 16-year-old boy who, it's him, his mum and his sister in the household. And it's basically what happens to his life once his mother is murdered and taken away from him and his struggle to survive.
And this is right at the start, so it's not giving anything away. His mother is brutally murdered.
Yeah.
Tell us something more about what happens.
So she, unfortunately, is killed and he's left with the pieces and he has to figure out a way of, one, surviving for himself and, two, surviving for his sister. And what's left behind with her death is, you know, he's got to figure out financial ways of supporting them. But this is all happening during the Brixton riots as well.
Yeah, so this is 1981. And anybody who's old enough to remember that, as I am, will remember what was going on. But for anyone else, talk about what was Brixton like in 1981 and what led up to the events that happened?
So I think those that are old enough know about the Suss Laws. So there was a period in Brixton where there was a lot of stop and searches in a very, very short space of time. So a lot of young men were stopped and searched, and it created a very, 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 very tense environment. Because of that environment, it triggered off the riots.
And there's also, I mean, almost an aside at the very, very start of the book, Michael spends the night in a cell and
yes.
he basically witnesses a, or is aware of a death in custody, which obviously yeah. was something that was going on a lot.
Yeah, so in the 80s, there was a lot of young men that did die in custody. And in the story, it depicts this. Michael has a local friend that he gets arrested with, and he ends up in a cell, but he overhears his friend being murdered, his friend being killed by the police. He has no evidence, he wasn't a witness, but he suspects he knows what went on.
Over to Nigeria, the same time mm-hmm. period, and we're introduced to Ngozi.
Yes.
And she is described by other characters as Osu. What does that mean?
So basically, Osu means that if you go back to when the enslaved African woman was taken from Africa. Now, when she took her child off of her back, she threw the child into a shrine. So when she threw the child into a shrine, that child basically became protected by the gods or of that time. So she became, that line became untouchable.
Untouchable in terms of a sort of caste system.
Yes, in terms of people not wanting to go near them because they are protected by the gods. For her, it means that, particularly in terms of marriage, that because she has this hanging over her head, that people don't want to marry her, and that she's ostracised to a certain degree, but she is, for instance, some of the children make fun of her and don't want to come, you know, make fun of that she's Osu. And it makes her life difficult.
So the village that she's growing up in is the village that our narrator was snatched from mm-hmm. 200 years or so previously.
Mm-hmm.
What is that place like at the time of the novel in 1981?
Well, the village, which is a made-up village, Oboe, it's a Catholic village. It's full of hierarchy systems, like many villages. You have the rich, you have the poor, and you have the very, very poor. And she's part of the very poor.
And the bigger city that she moves to, so she's basically going to move to as a maid of a household.
Yeah, so her mother is basically, because they are very poor, her mother has no options left to her but to send Ngozi off to work as a maid in order for her to get a better education and hopefully a better life.
And that's obviously not, we won't give away too much about what happened, but mm-hmm. that is not how things transpire. And so I want to talk about the sort of central idea behind the book of that, you know, how trauma is basically passed down through the yeah. generations.
Okay, so for instance, if we go back to Michael and his life and some of the reasons why his mother is murdered, that is involved in that. If we look at Michael, some of the legacies that he's left with, some of the internalization of racism, the way he views himself in the world, that is all handed down that's a legacy of slavery, yeah.
I mentioned at the beginning that you've been, you know, this book was conceived 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Let's talk about how it came about then and the sort of writing of it over those years.
Yeah. So what I was working in Scotland over 20 years ago, and I didn't have a TV. So I thought to myself, OK, well, this is a great opportunity. And at the time, I had a lot of ideas milling around in my head. So I sat down and I thought, OK, I'm going to write this novel. And I was also homesick. So I started to write the novel. And the first story that came out was Michael. Then after him, then Ngozi. But while I was writing those stories, a voice started to come forward saying, actually, I want to tell this story. So that's when the narrator also came forward as well.
And so how then does it take 20 years?
Well, I actually finished the first draft in 6 months. But what happened is that after the 6 months, I sent it out and obviously got a whole load of rejections. And I thought, OK, let me just rewrite and re-edit. So I rewrote and re-edit, sent it out again, got a whole load of rejections, left it alone for a little while, tried again, sent it out, got a whole load of rejections. And finally we got to 2017, and I thought to myself, okay, I'm going to do it one last time. And I sent it out and I got a whole load of rejections again. So I thought, okay, it's not going to happen for me the traditional route. I'm going to go down the self-publishing route. So I got the document together, and in the process of getting the document together, I came across a letter from 20 years ago, which said, at the bottom of it, keep in touch. So I thought to myself, should I? Should I not? So I thought, well, what do I really have to lose? So I phoned up, obviously changed the code and left a message on the answer machine. And they got back to me and said to me, what are you talking about? So I said, you sent me this letter 20 years ago and you said I should keep in touch. So they said, oh, send me a copy of the letter. So I said, OK, I'll send you a copy of the letter. And meanwhile, here's three chapters as well. So I sent it off to them and then I think I didn't hear from them for about 3 months. And I thought, OK, well, that's just another rejection. And I was sat down to actually just get the book ready to go down to just post it on for self-publishing. And an email came in saying, we've just read these three chapters. Do you have a synopsis, etc.? And sent it off to them and they helped find a agent for me, and the agent helped find Doubleday.
So what do you think had changed? Because clearly the book hadn't changed.
So in terms of obviously over 20 years, when you're rewriting, you're re-editing, I like to think that maybe my writing had got better. But also I think it was the right time as well, because I think the industry was changing and maybe some doors were opening as well.
So it took that long for the publishing industry it still has a long way to go, obviously, but, but to start actually welcoming what they would describe as other voices, I guess, into publishing.
I think it's a combination. I think that, hopefully my writing got better, but also it hit a time when the doors were opening.
And so obviously over that period of time, mm-hmm. I mean, that's 20 years of, from the conception of the book to it being published. The book set in 1981 as well, which is further in the past.
Yes.
Brixton, the place that, a part of the book is set, has changed beyond recognition in that time.
People say beyond recognition. It's changed in terms of when you walk down the streets, some houses have got nicer paint on it, but there's still the same buildings, but the actual people have changed, yes.
Yeah, well, and certainly the pictures in the estate agents' windows and things have, certainly got higher figures on them. Let's talk about that. The idea that when you conceived this book 20 years ago, you wanted to document a community, which I guess presumably at that time you wouldn't necessarily have conceived that community would be under threat in the way that it has become.
No, not at all. I think when I started to write it, I was homesick. So I was reading books at the time that I didn't feel. I mean, there were obviously maybe other books around, but the ones that I was reading just didn't seem to reflect the people that I knew. So I wanted to write something about their resilience. But during that process, what was happening is, as you said, people were either moving out and going back to the Caribbean, immigrating, or passing away, and the community was changing. There's still a community there, but not to the extent it was before.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I've just come back. My wife's an American, and I've just been visiting my mother-in-law in who lives in South Carolina. We went to Charleston, beautiful, old, rich town built entirely on the legacy of slavery. And, you know, we visited places while we were there, museums and, you know, houses that were, you know, once owned by large slave owners.
Yeah.
But, you know, everywhere is doing something to deal with that legacy, you know, in their own way.
Yes.
It's acknowledged. And, you know, I mean, America is obviously a society riven by the race issue, but it's acknowledged. It's something that you'll see discussions about on television. And then, you know, I come back and then, I don't know, Stormzy or Dawn Butler or whoever will go on TV and mention that perhaps, maybe, possibly, Britain is a society that's a little bit racist, and there is outrage. This is not something that people are willing to talk about. What do you make of that?
Well, I'm black, and if you or members of your family are going to be subject and feel it, then obviously you're not going to like it. But it's also difficult talking to, you know, you talk to some people and it's like a blank stare or deaf ears. It doesn't matter what you say, they're not going to hear what you know. Sometimes it's been like being locked in a box. You're talking, but you're not being heard. So there's that aspect of it. But then there is also the people that generally do want to hear and do want to learn. And I have come across those people. They're not as many as there should be, but they are there.
Well, there was a poll somewhere I saw only a week ago or so that was said something like, you know, 30% of the population think the empire was a force for good or something.
Yeah.
Britain, it certainly seems, needs to have some sort of acknowledgement of its of its legacy in the world before we, you know, some sort of reckoning, just to admit our part in that, and it just never seems to happen.
But it's also people also not understanding their own history. They say it's a force for good, but they're thinking as those that were beneficiaries of that, and a lot of white people were, but there were a lot of white people that in terms of Australia that were sent out. So were they, do you understand?
Yeah.
Sometimes I think white people have a false idea of their own history as well.
What more do you think needs to be done to, because as I said, I can't really see us moving on until we've, you know, just confronted that
I think
question.
We need to have conversations and we need to listen. We, you know, I'm hoping that the Book of Echoes, as I said, I think it's a good book for book clubs, and I hope it will open up conversations that people can have.
Can we talk about what other writing was perhaps an influence on this, on your work?
Yeah. In terms of the actual narrative, the enslaved woman's narrative, the abolitionist, Olalde Equiano, you know, had quite a bit of influence in trying to understand what it was like in those times and her journey as well. In terms of my writing influences as I was growing up, there's been so many, but I'll just name a few people like J. California Cooper, James Baldwin, George Eliot. The list goes on.
And to finish off, can I perhaps get you to read us a little bit of the Book of Echoes?
Yes. Okay. So this is a section that is right at the beginning of the book, and it's the enslaved African woman explaining what's happened to her. 200 years Wind and I have roamed. 200 years we have waited by these docks, and in that time we have seen many changes, watched many beginnings. I am their beginning, the womb whence they came. It was not out of choice that my children were separated. Not out of choice I was joined with their fathers. Uzo, my firstborn, was a round and healthy baby who giggled when I tickled him under his chin. Eze, my husband, was proud. We were happy in our small village, surrounded by the lush green bush, which shaded us from the African sun. We woke to the sound of the cockerel, and each morning I rose from the mat where we lay to clang my pot on top of an open fire and fetch water from the stream as Uzo slept peacefully on my back. Eze, my husband, was a kind man who I grew to love. I was 16, he much older. I remember the day he came to carry wine and I became his wife. That day we heard the Oja flute in the distance and it soared like an excited bird in flight before being joined by the rhythm of the Ogon and the beating of drums drawing nearer. My mother fretted, but my friends poked their heads out of the hut, eager to see what was happening, and reported back happily on their first impressions of Eze and his family. I sat while my aunts added my final adornments. I could hear so much fanfare outside, my spirit soared, and when, some time later, I finally handed Eze the cup to drink from, he took it in such a gentle manner that I was happy with my parents' choice. I thought many things back then. My future was young with fresh virgin cheeks. I thought I would grow old. I thought our lives would be entwined forever. That I would wake each morning to Eze's smile and the warmth of our baby between us. That I would rise each morning to clang my pot on top of the open fire, stir the food to feed my husband, and send him on his way to labour in the far fields. As he would say, with my sweet cooking wrapped in banana leaves, securely placed in the pouch by his side. I thought I would die in our small village, surrounded by the green bush, not far from my father's land, and the people who loved me. I could not see into the future, nor could I have imagined what it held. I did not know how the disease of others could infect my life. It killed me. I was 25. Wind and I have never known that kind of happiness. There was never enough time, or laughter, or peace, or words. You see, at first he could not speak my language, nor I his. For although his skin was black like mine, he came from their land. But we held on, Wind and I. From the moment we locked eyes, there was comfort in his gaze, a strength I needed that day as I walked unsteadily onto that ungodly ship with its huge wooden spears that rose into the heavens and the layers of white cloth at its feet. My back was in pain from the weight of the shackles at my neck and wrists. As I prayed for my son Uzo, I had left in a shrine. I looked up, and there was Wind, scaling down the pole. His face seemed strange among their ghostly ones. I wondered how and why he could betray us so. Then he looked up, right at me, and our eyes met, and he wheeled me to fight. I could not look away. He held my gaze as I descended into that hell, giving me strength. I never let go. That was the last day I ever saw Africa while alive.
So I've been talking to Rosanna Amaka. We've been talking about her debut novel, The Book of Echoes, which is out now in the UK from Doubleday. Rosanna, thank you so much for taking the time to share it with me.
Thank you.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.